Awesomeness. And welcome back. Hey, it's Rob Santor. How are you, man?
I'm good, Christy. How's it going?
You've gone into darkness, which actually doesn't surprise me because that's kind of what you do sometimes.
Well, let's give it a whirl and see if it helps the audio quality at all.
Okay. So we wanted, where we left off, we were talking about this investigation into the murder of Lawrence Bryan IV. And where we left off was Tiffany Chisholm and the apartment. And so I kind of left a lot of things hanging with that, in part because how we found out some of it came from jail calls that y'all got after. But tell us about what you, first of all, what you found in that search warrant, because there's some stuff that was found in that apartment that was kind of, it ended up being such a big deal at trial.
Yeah, so there were some things we found in the house that ended up being kind of critical. Some of that stuff was clothing. Specifically, there were like some black t-shirts with like either one sleeve cut off. And so there would be like a shirt with one sleeve cut off, the sleeve kind of hanging, or, you know, kind of just in the closet, and then some gloves and things like that. And yeah, so that doesn't necessarily sound like a big deal. But again, when we go back to like what Kieran said about, you know, a hat and a mask, but he could see sort of like the eyes and the nose portion of the face. You know, you can pull a shirt sleeve down over your face, almost like a stocking cap, all the way down.
And you kind of did that, right?
Yeah. So I remember like, and Breeden might be a good one to ask about that when it's his turn to talk. But I remember, you know, like I was kind of excited about it. I was like, this is what they use this for, man. Like, and this fits to a T with what Kieran described. And then, you know, everybody's kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know? And so I was like, well, let me do it on the stand in the trial. And so we did that. And when I pulled the sleeve down over my face, it was, I think, pretty compelling.
Oh, it was very compelling. But I think, you know, there are other elements to it, and you kind of glossed it, but like that sleeve being cut off, the sleeve itself was hanging on a wire hanger in the closet, according to the picture. Right. And then there had also been sleeves cut off of black t-shirts that were in Tiffany's car.
Yeah. So we found them both in the closet at the house and in her car. In the car, we found like a black bucket hat, a black bucket kind of style hat, and the cut sleeve with the sleeve was shoved in, like the door sleeve, along with some of his work receipts. And then the rest of the t-shirt was in the trunk. Like, so the just the sleeve was in the passenger compartment of the car. And then the rest of the t-shirt was in the trunk. And then he had like a jacket with some latex gloves and things like that in the trunk as well. So there were, you know, there were lots of things between the search warrant on the house and the car that were circumstantially, I think, compelling evidence. And then, of course, we found some of the ballistic evidence. We found a couple magazines. Some of them were not the right caliber, but one of them was. It was an extended 9mm magazine, so a 30-round mag, and that was a kind of an off-brand, but it would have fit a Glock, which obviously was important to us because we were looking for a Glock. Right. So yeah, so there was that kind of stuff, and then we found some other clothing just to associate Taman with Fred Wessels and Hitch Village, which is not necessarily relevant, other than it was supportive evidence from what like Malika and Brittany said, is that that's where he was from, that's where he spent his time. So we ended up seizing some of those clothing items, some of the Jamal Elliott memorative Hitch Village, Fred Wessels stuff. We seized that stuff as evidence. And
And you talk about that, and we are going to talk about Jamal Elliott, and we're going to talk about some of these other people, that the memorial stuff in there, because that connection kind of it informs this whole investigation. It is part of the whole background of what still is going on in Savannah right now.
Yeah. There was some back and forth around that time between, when I say at that time, I'm talking probably 2013, 2014, when there was some beef between some of the Yamacraw guys and the Fred Wessels Hitch Village guys. And that spanned like the Ardarian Jefferson murder, Jamal Elliott, and a few others. So there was some of that back and forth. And it even, like you said, it ended up playing a role as we approached trial in this case and some of the things that happened towards the eve of trial.
Right. And you know, I keep saying, we're going to get to that. But, you know, when you saw these things, you actually were smart enough to hold on to them. Because, you know, that, you know, these little pieces added up to a much bigger story, and we were able to present all of that to the court. And I think, you know, that again is just one of those hats off to you, because, you know, good eye, you know, that you knew this was important. What else was in the house? So we've got magazines, we've got a backstrap, I think, for a Glock, right?
Yeah, there was a backstrap to a Glock 9mm. There were some of his work receipts, and even for that day, I think we found the one for August the 7th, which ended up being relevant because he was like an hour late to work that morning. So that one was important. So again, yeah, it wasn't like we didn't find the gun, which we missed by like 15 minutes. If I was just 15 minutes sooner, we probably would have had the gun, because getting back to Tiffany Chisholm, where we left off, that's what was in her purse. It was the gun. So she like literally had the murder weapon in her purse as I'm sitting there talking to her. And I ended up figuring that out later on through the jail call. So if you can imagine in real time, I'm just kind of talking to her. Remember, she said her son was in her friend's apartment. She just wanted to go check on him. So then, yeah, she goes in, comes back out without the purse. Like I said, I realized it at the time, but I wasn't thinking like she was attempting to hide a murder weapon or anything like that, which, you know, I probably should have been. And I guess it's sort of a learning lesson. I don't think that I would have had enough to seize it at that point anyway, or to say, hey, no, you can't do that. It's just one of those things. Even if I was suspicious of it, I would have probably had to let it go. But
all right, you didn't have PC to go into her purse at that point in time.
Yeah, like she was kind of off the out of the box. She wasn't in, you know, we didn't have anything on her. So it was at that time, it just was what it was. And then, you know, we executed the search warrant, found, like you said, it's the details. And then I would say, like in any murder case, that's what you need to be honed in on. It's like, it's the details. And sometimes you don't get that smoking gun where you find the murder weapon or you had a confession. But, you know, if you can build the case with enough detail, that's where cases are either, the tough cases are either made or not made, in my opinion. Right. So, yeah, so we found some of that stuff that was detail stuff in the apartment. And then, of course, I pulled his jail calls within a day or two after that. And did the execution on the car. So we did the house, the car, and then pulled the jail calls. And, you know, lo and behold, he's calling out of the booking area to Tiffany and to Carlos Richardson, and kind of coordinating and almost like facilitating the communication between Tiffany and Los to get the gun out of the apartment. Because he got a sense once the traffic stop happened, and then just the way it all went down, he's a savvy enough guy where he knew it was more than just like a random traffic stop for guns and drugs. He's, you know, and even in the jail calls, he was saying it's way more than that. It's way more than what you think it is. And like, he knew what time it was. So he started on the phone pretty consistently that night, and was coordinating that gun to get out of that apartment and into Lois's hands.
Right. And so there are a whole bunch of calls, and we played a good chunk of them, but not all of them at trial. And when we talk about trial, I want to talk about like how well thought out your plan for this trial was. I was just kind of present. Because you really, by the time this got to trial, you had you really had a very distinct idea of how to present this from an evidentiary standpoint. You know, that is, again, it is a great thing for both of us, like for me to know how you've pieced all this together, and you know, also your experience by that point in time, like you've been in a whole bunch of trials, you've seen everything that can go to hell. It's like, we know like what foundational elements we need. We know what we need to get this evidence and make sure that it is admissible in court. So that was really, it made a huge difference, I think, when we finally got to trial on this.
Well, you say that being nice, but I mean, you're the one that did it. You know what I mean? You're the one that presented it. You're the one that did all that work. And sometimes in my mind, I have an idea like, this is what I think is a good idea, but like, you're the one that knows how to get it in. You're the one that presents it to the jury in a way they can understand. And I think it was just helpful, my experience at that point, because the case got dumped on you kind of late. It wasn't like dumped on you, but it kind of was, right? I mean, it happened with the Rebecca Foley case and this case, which are two huge cases. Yeah. You just kind of ended up with at like the 11th hour. And, you know, I was grateful that you were able to help us with it, or help me with the cases. Yeah. Because neither one of those cases was easy. And, you know, Frank did a great job with each one of those all the way through until the time he left, but he ended up leaving for another position, which was understandable to everybody, but it was not the best timing for these trials. So, you know, you had to do a ton of work in a short period of time. So don't undersell yourself either.
Well, I'm not, but you know, again, I didn't spend hours transcribing those jail calls either. So, on top of the hours you spent investigating this case to begin with. And I saw your, what was the 96 page search warrants at this point? I think we were up to like some significant numbers in, you know, the page.
Yeah, there was some lengthy search warrants. And then, yeah, like, this is a little bit of a tangent, but like those are some of like the inglorious parts of the job that like nobody talks about. Like, you don't see that on TV, right? So like when you have a trial, right, everybody just sees the courtroom and sees like the prosecutor presenting the gun to the jury and all this kind of stuff. But like in a case like Hooper's or, you know, in the Rebecca Foley case, there's just like tons of evidence. And when you're the detective, like it's your job, like basically you become a manual laborer for a moving company on the day and the weeks of trial, because it's your job to get all that evidence to the courthouse. It's your job to move it from the prosecutor's office or the secure area in the prosecutor's office to the courtroom. And sometimes that requires, you know, it's wardrobe.
Sometimes it requires a dolly.
and it's heavy, you know, and half the time it's like the middle of August in Savannah. So it's like 110 degrees. You're wearing a freaking suit, like lugging this boatloads of evidence and shit. It's just like, you sweat your ass off. And nobody ever told me that stuff about becoming a detective. Like, this is what you do, you know? And then, right. You know, spending hours transcribing jail calls for aides in trial. It's like,
or on the phone with Sharon Robbins. I mean,
yeah. Well, I mean, you know, those are just things in the job that nobody preps you for, or, you know, again, it's inglorious, so nobody puts it on their TV shows and stuff like that, right. But that's becomes a big part of your life. Right. You know, when you're doing this line of work. So,
right. I get to be part of the flashy, exciting things, or the things that, you know, the public finds exciting, I guess. They really aren't, honestly. But because there's a lot of boring stuff that happens in court too, but you're right that the public does not understand the amount of real work that goes into this. And so like listening to jail calls, you listened to hours of jail calls, then, you know, I listened to them, you know, like the ones that you collected for me, like you'd honed it down. I listened to them, and then you have to go back and transcribe them because of you know, how we wanted to present this to the jury, which I kind of want to save that for when we talk about trial, because it is like very, very cool the way this worked. But what, you know, you listen to these calls, and were you just sitting there in your head going, fuck?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like an understatement, right? You're like, it's like, seriously, by like 5 minutes, you know, you're like, fuck, like five minutes sooner, you know, I could have got to the house. I would have had it, you know, and then we wouldn't be in this position where we're trying to, you know, get other ballistic evidence in through other cases, and which we didn't end up doing anyway, but like, you know, and we'll talk about it, but yeah, there was a lot of effort put into like those other Niven correlations we talked about last time, of like figuring out a way to try to get them into a trial as admissible evidence, and in a way that it wouldn't cause us an appeal issue. And, you know, there was a ton of work that went into that. But, you know, had it just been like 5 minutes sooner, it's like, you know, we would have had it. And I guess this goes back to the volume of work we had at the time. You know, it was like, I got in Jimmy Temple like 2 days before this. And, you know, so I'm trying to juggle these two or three cases at the same time. And it's like, to me, that's when it becomes like an organizational failure, right? They didn't have enough detectives. They didn't have enough staff. And like, it causes us these types of failures, right? Like, and we never recovered the murder weapon. So like, Tiffany got rid of it, gave it to Lois. Lois did whatever he did with it. And we never found it. And so like, now the case is at not as good of a place. And
well, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
Well, you say that, and I agree on one level, but the jail calls really helped us in the end, because it corroborated some things, like the minutia corroborated again. Like, Malika Spencer says that she saw Timon Hooper and Carlos Richardson talking about this murder. The fact that Los is on those jail calls, that Los is the person that Timon, and I call him Timon. I know he likes to go by Timon. I do it on purpose because it pisses him off, because he spells it Timon. So I'm going to call him Timon. but I know, like, it made him mad every time I said it in the courtroom. And I'm not here to please him. So, but she's, you know, that corroborates Malika, that this is the guy he's in this with. And the fact that, you know, you had interviewed Lois, you recognized his voice, all of those things. This is somebody who is definitely known to police. And, you know, that was huge with this. Tiffany identified him as the person that she gave this gun to, and the other things that she took out of the apartment. And in the call, and I didn't, you know, I used a little clip of it on the preview for this, the trailer for this episode. But Tiffany, you know, you hear them counting the things she's taken out. Like, I think they're all gun and gun parts or you know, magazine, whatever, ammunition. And they're counting them. It's like, how many should there be? And you know, where did you find them? Did you check this spot? Timon is ugly to her on some level, because, you know, this woman's like taking some risks for him. And she also is kind of like, oh, this is so cool and fun. I'm, you know, like getting things past the police. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think like it's the next best thing, right? Like, I mean, I think that if I were to ask you, would you rather have the murder weapon from his house?
Yeah.
Okay. Or all this other stuff? You know,
well, like, I'd like to have both, you know, both.
Yeah. I mean, both would be the best of everything, but I mean, that's going to be your direct evidence, which is huge, because forensically it ties into the scene and everything like that. So I understand what you're saying, but I think it's like, you know, it's, and just the amount of work and effort it took to tie all that stuff up and together. We were kind of fortunate we were able to do it. So.
Yeah. But I mean, that again is your work, because not everybody pulls the jail calls and listens to them. So, you know, I realize that you think that that's like super basic that everybody does that, but it really did not happen in every case that I had from the Savannah Police Department.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So you did. And, you know, part of what was cool with this too is like, there's all this discussion with Lois about like, Lois was driving by and they're signaling to each other, like while she is talking to you at the apartment.
Yeah.
Signaling to Lois, like don't pull up right now, you know.
Yeah, because then she was afraid that they thought she was trying to set him up and all this kind of stuff. Because, I mean, imagine what was going through her head, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
And what was interesting, because of the way everything played out, we were able to understand what was going through her head, because she was able to tell us. But I mean, yeah, I was like, yeah, so he rolled up and like I'm out in the apartment parking lot talking to her, and he drives by, you know, because that's where she was supposed to meet him and give him the gun. And she still ended up doing that. Once we ended up going up to the apartment, she ended up reconnecting with Lois, and that was also on a jail call. Like, it was recorded while she was like dumping the guns back off to him. So there was a three-way call between Hooper and Tiffany and Lois, and you know, they're making the dump or the handoff of the gun. And so that was also very interesting. But it was yeah, it was one of those where you're listening to it, and this was only like a couple of days after it happened. I was like, damn it, dude, really? You know, like
yeah. So you pull her in and you interview her, and actually I've left probably a couple of things out, and I know that like you did the search warrant on the car. There were some really, you know, good things you got in those pictures with the car that I think you put together a little bit later as well. After you got her phone, was that part of the interview process you had with her when you got her phone?
No, so that was part of the original search warrant. So we wanted the phones inside of the house, and hers was on the nightstand, and you know, that was, we weren't really sure which phone or which side of the bed he had access to. And so we ended up writing, I ended up writing another warrant for her phone. And plus, besides at that point, we seized the phone as part of the original search warrant on the apartment. But then once we got the jail calls, now she's like in the conspiracy, right? So she, you know, her phone becomes sort of open season, for us to write a warrant on it. And then, that's what happened. And so Timon just had like a little shitty flip phone, and Tiffany had a smartphone. So we were able to write a warrant on her phone, and we were able to go back. And that was another critical piece of evidence. Probably the most important piece of evidence we got out of the house was her phone, because she didn't delete anything. She had the conversations back from August. So this would have been right, a sort of Halloween night going into November 1st. And she had the conversations back from August with Timon. And those text conversations were key, because, you know, it's obvious he has her car. He's telling her, I can't move the car. They got the street blocked off. And she's like, where the fuck are you? You know, and by right. Then too, we had Hooper's records. So we saw the calls between him and her right around the time of the murder anyway. They were making actual phone calls to each other. And then the text messages earlier in the morning, and it was like 5-6 o'clock in the morning. And then, you know, he's like, I'm going to be on the way, you know, once they unblock the road. I'm near Skidaway, which Dwayne Court is like right near Skidaway Road. So like, he's basically putting himself in the area, which we knew from the phone tower information, but it was nice to get that, like, hey, the road's blocked off. So now we know he's got her car. He's talking about the roads blocked off. So then my next step was like, were there any other roads? I knew Dwayne Court was blocked off, right? We talked about that earlier, because we just stopped all traffic in and out of there. So then the next question is, were there any other road closures that morning? So I pulled up the CAD history for like every CAD call in the city. And I went through them all to see if there was any other road closures. And Dwayne Court was the only one. So now it's like, all right, now he's got the car. The car is within basically the crime scene. And, you know, so I started going through some of the old crime scene photos too. Now that, you know, it's a couple months later, and I'm like, all right, I got this information. His car had to be somewhere in there, right? So then I'm like, I wonder if we got it in any of our crime scene pictures. So this is another learning point. So for me, we did do pictures of like the immediate crime scene, right? Some of the like immediate surrounding area, I would say kind of inner scene, outer scene, but we didn't take pictures of like every parking lot in Dwayne Court. And it would have only taken probably, you know, 20 minutes for the photographer to go around and just kind of get pictures and note tags and things like that. And so like now, as I, cause you're learning every day, as I go through scenes, I'm like, all right, like we really need to branch out and document not just what's right in front of us. We need to document what's around us, because we never know what's going to happen. And like, we were fortunate enough that remember we were talking about Dominique Daniels and how they drove in. Right. So we were getting some pictures of Dominique Daniels' car, the one he rolled into the scene with. And that was the main focus of the pictures. But in Selva's pictures, like there was some of the other parking lots in the backdrop. And like, so I zoomed way, way in to see like the cars way, way out there. And, you know, like sure as shit, there's a car. I can't say it's the car because you can't read the tag from that far away, but it's the car. And right. because it's an 08 Malibu, it's got some very distinct trim pieces, window shape, color, all that kind of stuff. And like, it was like, there it is, you know? Yeah. So we're like, all right, that's awesome.
And one of the other things about where that car was is it's the direction that Kieran said those guys ran from.
Right. From and to.
Yeah.
To afterwards. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really like just key to me. I mean, you did such amazing work, you know, like zooming in all these pictures and just, you know, like just hunting it down, just, you know, just bulldog, well, hound dogging it, whatever. There's a term for that that I don't know, obviously.
Raw dogging it.
There it is. No, that was not it. Thank you for sharing.
I can't believe Miss Linda called me out with the blow up doll thing last time, dude.
She loves you, man.
Yeah, no, I love her too.
And we are all seriously going to get together and have a conversation because I think that is, you know, that this relationship that came out of this, I think, is one of those great things that does really change how the community functions, and I think that's really important. But I felt like it was really cool, all of these things that you did with the information that you got from Tiffany's phone, because we also had conversations like she's texting people the morning after, like she's having phone conversations with Timon. And then she's like texting her, is it her sister or cousin? Like,
yeah, she's searching the news too and asking like, do you know who LB4 is, or, you know, LB? And
yeah, she sends a picture of him, I think.
Yeah, she did. She like pulled a picture of him off his Facebook page and sent it. Like, you know this guy. And
yeah.
And this was like, this was before, like, we still had the crime scene taped off. Like, you know what I mean? It was like, we weren't even done at the scene yet.
Right. And again, the timing of a lot of this, like, you all unblocked the road and it made Timon late for work.
Yeah. Yep. That's why he was an hour late.
Yeah.
I think like Pennington used to say, like, is death by 1,000 paper cuts, right? It's like all these little things add up to one big picture.
Right. Right. And that certainly was true in this case. So you actually pulled her in to talk to her, and you had some of the phone stuff by then, right? I know you had the calls.
I'm pretty sure the first time I only had the jail calls and stuff, I think the first time. And then I think I tried to get her in one other time. So there were a total between, in addition to the proffers, like I had like 7 interviews with Tiffany Chisholm. So yeah. They blur together. Each one was as painful as the last, but
they're all really, really long. I did listen to all of them and they're really long. Cause you tried.
You know, it was so frustrating because, you know, Tiffany was a good person, I think. She
before she met Tom.
Yeah, you know, even after, I think her heart kind of has always been in the right place, but she, you know, she fell in with this guy and got manipulated, and you know, I think that at the end of the day she did the right thing, but you know, it was like she kind of, well, I mean, she put her own life at risk. Is what ended up happening by becoming involved in all this. And, you know, but she made those choices.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like she made those choices. Like at the very beginning, if I sat down with her and she was just like, hey, look, this is what I know. And was just honest. Like none of the other stuff would have had to happen.
Right.
But it, you know, she was trying to protect him. She loved him and, you know, just made some really bad decisions that got her into a years long ordeal with this case. And, you know, I do in ways I feel bad for her, but like we said, it's also like, you know, it's her own decision. She understands that though. And I think she, by the time it was all said and done, she owned it. And, you know, I think she understood more,
the bigger
as things played out. Yeah. As things played out.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, you sit there, you know what the score is, right? Like you go in this interview with her, I know what the score is. And I'm just trying to get her like, Tiffany, look, like you don't want to be involved with this. Like, I know more than you think I know, because she's playing kind of like, oh, I don't know. You know, like he doesn't do anything bad. He's getting his life together and, you know, all this kind of bullshit. And
she wouldn't even own that she was taking the gun out of the apartment though.
And it's, yeah,
the
yeah.
way she says it, it's like so obvious.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and the way the conversations leading up to that and afterwards, the jail calls, it is very, very clear what he is asking her to do. I mean, he doesn't use the word gun, but it's like everything but that. Like, she's like, you know, I got, what is it? She doesn't use the term magazine. What is her term?
She said the piece. I got the piece.
Yeah, I got the piece of it and I got this. And you're like, so she knows exactly what she was supposed to be doing. And where she was supposed to look for things and what was there and all of that stuff. And it just was, she just didn't want to own that particularly early. You're right. It was incredibly frustrating for you. And then there's this whole massive frustration that everyone had with Bond.
Yeah. So, you know, he gets popped with the traffic stop, the gun and the drugs, but he was not on at that point. He was not on any kind of supervision. So he wasn't on parole or probation or anything like that. So,
but he's a convicted felon. So he's not allowed to have a gun.
That's correct. But he was, yes, in the recorder's court, he was issued a bond. And during that hearing, I failed a little bit, cause I didn't go to that, the arraignment hearing for him. Cause I guess I sort of assumed that he wouldn't get a bond, being he had a little bit of a criminal history with a gun before and that kind of thing. But, I wasn't there, so I can't say this for sure, but I guess I just don't know that the real significance of his arrest and what his role was in the, Lawrence Bryan murder was to the judge. I feel like if the judge was better informed, it wouldn't have happened, is my opinion.
Well, and I don't know exactly what was done either. You know, obviously I came into this significantly later. The way it was told to me though, is that the judge, I think, was told that he was under investigation. But you know, it at a minimum was told that the feds would be looking at this firearm case. And oh, by the way, please don't let him out, because you know, this is bigger than you think it is, kind of thing.
It's way bigger than what you think it is.
Exactly. So Judge O'Dell gave him a bond, and that leads to its own little political mess. That was part of it. And then you and Frank basically went to the U.S. Attorney's office and said, this guy needs to be charged federally for the firearm charge.
Yeah.
That was a long time too.
Oh yeah, it did. Cause what it ended up, it was like November. I think it was like a couple weeks, before it was squared away. But, I will say that, Jenna Solari, you know, was amazing to work with. I can't say that for every U.S. attorney I've ever worked with or consulted with. They're not always easy to get along with, and they're not always willing to put themselves out there a little bit for somebody else's case. But she was I don't have anything but good things to say about her and the way she handled that part of it. And so they got him, what do they call it, Christy, when is it a detainer? They put a detainer out on him.
Right.
And so then the U.S. Marshals, because he once the bond was issued, he posted it and he was out. So he got back out on the street.
Right. He'd been gathering money for that. Like, again, and that's totally in the calls.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been gathering money from the time he got arrested from various people. So,
and,
yeah.
You know, the concern for us was not just like the homicide investigation, but it was like, you know, this guy's, he's dangerous. He's out here committing armed robbery shootings. And, you know, it's like, how many unreported robberies or shootings has he been a part of? And plus we had all those Niven correlations to the 2014 stuff where there was like a ton of them, you know, big shootouts in the projects and things like that. They weren't just like, you know, around here or there. It was like, you know, fucking shootouts. And so, yeah, like it was a concern for public safety. Like this guy's out on the street doing these things. And based on what Malika and Brittany were saying, just had no qualms about any of it, was very proud of himself for doing these types of things. And so, I mean, that's a, not everybody's like that. I mean, that's a particular type of person, which even played out further on closer to trial when the threats were made. And then we'll get to that, you know, a little bit later.
Right. But so you all get the U.S. Marshals to issue a warrant for him. And this leads to part of why it took so long for this case to, you know, kind of resolve. Because U.S. Marshals had to try to find him.
Yeah. So they ended up, again, I wasn't privy to any of that. You know, they, once it's a federal case and they get kind of the baton handed to them, it's their, like it's their dog. So they're pretty much working it. And they basically will just call us whenever he's under arrest. So, they were doing their thing and I can't answer any questions on how it all actually played out or why or anything like that.
Neither can I know what I heard.
Yeah. But basically what happened was, they had eyes on the Malibu, thought that Cooper was, yeah. So Tiffany's 2008 Malibu, they thought, Hooper was in the car driving and, they attempt to stop it and block it in, I think in a parking lot. And again, depends on who you ask. The car is either driven directly at the U.S. Marshal or, you know, I think what Tiffany said was that she wasn't sure that they were cops and just kind of like got scared and whatever. And anyway, long and short is the marshals ended up, the task force, they ended up shooting around into the car or one or two, I can't remember. And one of them hit Tiffany in the neck.
Right.
And so, you know, the marshal was almost run over. Tiffany took one to the neck and Hooper was not in the vehicle. Hooper right. ended up being holed up in the apartment with Tiffany's son, which they relocated the ones that weren't involved in the shooting. Relocated, put him under arrest and secured the apartment again. And that's kind of what happened with Tiffany. And I was that November or was that early? I think it was early December.
It was December.
Right after Thanksgiving.
Right. And she got charged initially. That and charge ended up going nowhere because of the circumstances being unclear. And that affected a lot of things for her. So, but she also got charged with lying to you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were a couple of things going on at that time. Frank, and again, you know, to his credit, he did a lot of work to get her to come in. And you've mentioned the proffers to talk about what she knew. And you know, to get statements. And again, you know, those proffers, there were more of them than we normally would have. They were a lot longer than we normally would have in most cases. And I think, you know, some of that had to do with distrust on Tiffany's part. And that was, you know, it was a lot for both of you, but I do credit Frank for really having worked that and worked with the attorneys involved and you know just kind of figuring out what needed to happen with that whole situation. But that took a long time. Because that's like late 2015, right?
Yeah, that was like December 2015. Still more murders going on in Savannah. And yeah, so then once he was arrested on that night, he didn't go anywhere after that. He ended up, he pled guilty later on, I think in early 2016. I want to say it was February or March. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went to every federal hearing that he had. So I was in the back, just kind of watching. Yeah, that was important later. But because, you know, I had an interest in the outcome. So the most important thing it did was take him off the street so nobody else got hurt, number one. And then number two, it gave me more time because, you know, with the volume of cases we were getting, it was like I needed time. And so that gave me the time I needed to continue working.
Right. So he gets arrested, he gets charged, he pleads guilty, and he goes to federal prison in Jessup. Tiffany, she bonds out fairly early, I think.
Yeah, it was within a day or two, I think.
Yeah. And of course, you know, she had medical issues and all of those things. But she, you know, comes in and she proffers a couple of times. And it wasn't until, I believe, August of 2018? Or August of 2018? Yeah.
2018.
Yeah, August of 2018, her case is when her case finally got resolved. And Frank did handle that. It was one of the last things he did before. Actually, he went on to become a Fed. He's with the U.S. Attorney's Office. But that was a lot of work on his part, too. In the meantime, so, you know, we're talking all of this time. This is when you're doing all the searches of the cell phone records and just all of that kind of stuff. But there was a very big part of this investigation that you worked really hard on that we didn't get to present to the jury. And I know you were pissed about it. Let's talk about that just a little bit.
Well, I'm not pissed about it anymore.
I'm glad to hear that.
But no, so like I said, you know, I was so frustrated about missing the gun. And then it was like, well, what we had was the shell casings from Lawrence's murder scene. And by this point, they'd all been confirmed by ballistic firearm scientists. So they were no longer correlations. They were like actual matches. So the same gun that was used in the shooting of Lawrence Bryan, the murder weapon, was also used in a shooting where a guy named Denico Morris's house was shot up in 2014. And then one of the guns in that same shooting, we believe it was probably Danico's gun that returned fire because there were casings like inside the house leading outside. So all of like what I think are Hooper's casings, and this goes back to the 30 round magazine. There was like 30 of them outside in the street. Then you've got a bunch of casings like inside the door and leading onto the front porch. So return fire from most likely Danico Morris. The casings from the house matched another Yamacraw Village shooting during which Alan Sammons and I were able to locate an eyewitness to that shooting who identified Hooper. So we didn't have anybody saying they saw Timon Hooper shooting the gun that matched the scene of Lawrence Bryan or Danico Morris's house being shot up. However, there are other casings that link those two shootings of Danico Morris's house and then this Hitch Village. I think I might have said Yamacraw, but there was a Hitch Village Fred Wessels shooting where what we think is Danico Morris's gun was used. So you have ballistic ties to all three of those shootings. And you've got basically Hooper identified by an eyewitness on one end. And then you've got Malika and Brittany Boston as ear witnesses tying Hooper on the other end. So you got those two bookends, and then you've got all the ballistic evidence tied in between, but it's like super messy and dicey. And it was like, how can we firm this up so we can get it in? Because to me, if you can do that, it's almost as good as having the murder weapon. It's like, all right, like we can tie them to these other shootings that this gun was involved in. So right. that's what I tried to do.
Right. And of course, you know, part of the reason that we did not do that, go through that exercise at trial, you know, there were a whole bunch of legal issues with, you know, these prior bad acts and so on and so forth. But also getting the witnesses there, like the eyewitness who was able to identify Timon as being involved in one of the shootings. We were struggling to even try to find this person by the time the case came around.
We could have found him.
I know you could have found him because you can find anybody. But realistically, whether this guy would be willing to testify, just all of those things, because it still was kind of a free for all by the time we tried this case in 2019. So that was part of it. Part of it, and that shooting of Danica Morris's house, and am I right? Was someone, this gun or one of the guns involved in these frequent shootouts was involved in a homicide that killed a 2-year-old, right?
No.
Correctly? I'm getting it wrong.
Not through the ballistics, no. But the beef was tied together.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So they were tied through the people and through the ongoing conflict, but ballistically they were not.
Okay. And that is still under investigation at this point.
Yeah.
So again, we don't want to get into things that are still under investigation because again, there's all this unresolved violence that still exists in Savannah that was caused by these groups of people that just don't care, right? The most important thing to them is, did someone diss me? Or diss
my friend? I mean, at a certain point, it just becomes like this, you know, they shoot each other's houses up, they shoot each other's family members. So it's basically just shoot on site, no matter where you are, no matter what time of day, if you're downtown in broad daylight, if you're in City Market or, you know, it doesn't matter, River Street. It's just, it gets to that point where I think even nowadays, if you asked somebody like how this shit even start, like most people wouldn't remember, or it was down to something like so petty of like, you know, somebody shitted somebody else on a gun. And then, you know, then you have like these just years of violence and murder and injury. And it's just, it's crazy.
Right. Right. And it is just really insane. So the ballistics also, there was you mentioned Jamal Elliott. How does Jamal Elliott tie into Timon and to Tiffany and to this case?
So there's, that's also an unsolved case at this point. So I don't want to get too much into it detail wise, but Hooper's name came up in Jamal Elliott's murder as part of that investigation.
And Jamal was actually killed in Yamacraw though, right?
Jamal was killed in Yamacraw, but Timon Hooper was a close friend of his. So his name kind of came up on both sides of it as like a friend and or a person of interest, but I don't want to go too much more into the detail than that, but sure. His name came up into it. And again, it tied back into, you know, so Jamal was a Hitch Village, Fred Wessels guy. And I want to say his girlfriend maybe at the time was living in Yamacraw. So there was the Ardarian Jefferson murder, not too much longer prior to Jamal Elliott. And then, you know, like it is maybe about a year or so. And then, you know, then Jamal Elliott gets killed in Yamacraw. So there's this ongoing feud with Yamacraw and the HVP, Fred Wessels guys. And so, again, it's just a sort of an ongoing cycle of murders, and nobody wants to talk. And really, you know, they want to get their street justice versus through the legal system. So, yeah, so but that ended up playing a part because Jamal was Tiffany's cousin. And So that he was Tiffany's family.
Right. So there are two parts of this that I want to talk about. Like there, you mentioned there were memorial t-shirts and stuff for Jamal in Tiffany's apartment in the closet that had these cut off sleeves and things in it. What was the term they used to honor him? Was it Mac Life? Am I right about that?
Yeah, it was Mac Life because they would call him Mac Mall.
And that actually, it showed up in Facebook, you know, because eventually you had to do like these lengthy search warrants to get Facebook stuff for Timon and Los, and it turned into, you know, like a whole bunch of other people. But that was a theme that showed up in their Facebook pictures as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you mentioned
the whole Mac Life. Yeah.
Right. So you also mentioned HVP, and you know, we're talking in shorthand here. What is HVP?
They call it like Hitch Village Projects. It's, you know, basically like
Hitch Village Posse, right?
Yeah. And that's a group, right? So that was like the, I want to say one of the original groups out of that area. And it's kind of splintered into a few different other things now at this point, but that, like, the Hitch Village Posse was almost like the original kind of group out of there. And
you call it a group, I call it a gang, you know, because
yeah,
my experience with it.
Yep.
But HVP was basically a local gang, right?
Right.
And so, you know, Hitch Village, then you said it became Fred Wessels was like across the street, and now it's called something completely different that everyone still calls it Hitch Village. But HVP went way back. I mean, I prosecuted in Savannah, and HVP existed in the 90s. So, and early 2000s, and it did not morph into anything else that I'm aware of, because, you know, even in Timon's social media, they talk about HVP forever. And
yeah. Yeah. Like that's kind of, like I said, that's like the original kind of group out of there. And then I think, I want to say it was like SBE or something like that is what Timon and those guys were kind of repping also. And I don't remember what that stands for now, but I remember he had it on some of his clothes and hats and stuff. I think it was like SBE. Again, I don't remember at this point anymore what it stands for, but so yeah, there was HVP as kind of like the, I want to describe it almost like an umbrella for a lot of these guys. It's like you can rep something different, but you know, if you were from Hitch Village, you're HVP, like umbrella. So you might be SBE or you might be whatever else, but as long as you're all under the umbrella of HVP, you're kind of like one, you know, you're friends or whatever. You're not going to beef with each other.
It's kind of like, you know, the Bloods gang, and then you have all these subsets, right?
Right.
So that informed, again, like some of the people that Timon was associated with and that became people that we ended up needing to talk to in the lead up to trial. So yeah, this goes on. You're working. The next thing that I remember being big in this case was, I think, January 2017, you talked to Timon.
Yeah. So like, you know, he pleads guilty in, you know, early 2016, the rest of that year, I'm working the ballistic stuff, prepping my case file, getting everything together, getting everything to Frank. We are, I think, exploring some of the things with Tiffany, although I think most of that was later on. And then I'm working like other murders and other cases. So like I got promoted to sergeant in May of 2016. I got, I want to say, 3 murders in the first few months. I got Damon Card in January, and then I got Juwan McDowell's death in April, and then Kathy Henry's in May. So I was juggling 3 other murders, and then I got promoted to sergeant, kept in homicide in May, which that's a whole different story. I'll just touch on it just so people understand. I mean, it was like I had just inherited this office in total administrative disarray. I mean, it was like there were reports pending from like 2014 and you know, so like over 2 years where, you know, these
violent crimes, right?
Yeah. So it was like, you know, 2 years, these reports were pending, waiting for a supervisor to approve them. I had case files from like 2013 in the office still. So like, I think the first 6 weeks, this was like the most, I think, consecutive weeks over 100 hours I worked was like the first 6 weeks I was a sergeant. Cause I was trying to clean all that up on top of, you know, wrapping up the Laquan Givens case, which was Kathy Henry's murder. So I was promoted, I want to say like 4 or 5 days after that murder happened. So it was like, I was still working that case, then shifted into a role as a supervisor. And then trying to clean up the office. And then, you know, that again, we did the Theron Robbins case. That was June. So that was a couple weeks later. So I was 6 weeks in a row, I worked over 100 hours, just trying to make it all work.
All the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I look back now and, you know, I know you guys give me a hard time and make jokes about blow up dolls and stuff, but if I had a family at that point, there's no way I would have been able to do all that. So, you know, I was at a point in my life where I could
do it. Don't take that badly. We admire you.
I know. I'm just saying, and I admit I've definitely got better balance in my life now. You know, I don't think anybody would tell you that was healthy, but what I can say is I did, it was hard, but I always felt like I was doing right by the cases and by the work. So that's why I did it. But yeah, anyway, so that was what was going on through 2016. And I mean, that lasted, you know, I talk about the first 6 weeks, but I mean, that lasted. 2016 was another bad year for us. So it was through the end of the year. And so finally, like, you know, I just kind of met with Frank and he and I were talking and I think we just both agreed like, all right, it's time to just pull the trigger, man. Like, let's just charge it. It's not going to get any better than what we got unless we keep pressing. So let's just go for it. So I took John Garcia down to Jessup with me to serve the arrest warrant. And, you know, I remember telling John, I was like, yeah, he's probably not going to say anything, dude. We'll be in and out of here, you know? And so like, you know, I prepped a few things in the back of my head, but I was kind of not really anticipating he was going to talk. But yeah, we end up getting him in the office that down there. And those guys were always real good to us down in Jessup. They always real accommodating. Even when you and I went down there to talk to Henry Watson later on, they were very good to work with. And
absolutely,
you know, we get Hooper in the office and you know, I Mirandize him and we just get to talking. And yeah, he talked to us for about a half an hour. And
which was, yeah, that was a big surprise, honestly.
Yeah. And it made the case a lot better because what ended up, you know, I won't go into the whole statement, but the biggest things taken away from the statement that he said, you know, I asked him, I was like, you know, do you know anybody over on off of Duane Court? Like, do you have any reason to be over there? Like friends, family, anything like that? And he was like, no, I don't know anybody over there. I don't go over there. So he denied ever being over there, which we already knew wasn't true from the cell phone records, and from his text messages. But then the other thing was, you know, I asked him, you know, were you ever in a position where you needed to defend yourself? You know, did you have to, you know, self-defense, right? Like that was always an issue because Lawrence shot back, right? And we know Lawrence shot back and we know Lawrence was the one defending himself, but you never know how that's going to play in a trial. So, you know, he was like, nah, I don't know LB. You know, I've heard of him, but I don't know him. I didn't do that. That's what this is about. He kind of started laughing and stuff. And, you know, so yeah. And then I was able to ask him about like the cut sleeves on his shirt. I was like, why do you have like one sleeve cut off your t-shirt? You know? And he's like, I was hot, you know? So I was like, so you cut one sleeve off, you know?
Well, but he also like called those his work clothes. And that just made me so happy at trials. Like, yeah, this is your work clothes that you use to rob people.
Yeah.
That's your work.
Yeah. Well, what was funny too is we asked about the latex gloves, right? And so what he said was, I can't remember. I might be misquoting. I just remember him and Tiffany said two different things. So I asked Tiffany about the latex gloves, and I'm pretty sure she said he used them to wash dishes. Right. And then I asked him, and he was like, I use them to take the trash out. They're for my job. And so like they couldn't even get the story straight on the latex gloves or whatever, which, like you said, they're, it's robbery is what the job is. But so yeah, there were some very, very important things that came out of that interview, which I was excited to tell Frank once we got done with it. So he did give a brief statement. Eventually he was like, yeah, I'm done talking. I was like, all right, well, good luck to you, man. You know? Mm-hmm. So then, yeah, then we proceeded down the road of trial, but we were very cautious in when we brought him back, because maybe you can talk about that as far as the timelines of, like, once you bring him back from federal custody, you only have like, what, 180 days to get it tried or whatever.
Well, right. So there are a lot of, if the DA's office, after an arrest warrant issues from grand jury, which is, you know, this case was specially presented to the grand jury. So if an arrest warrant had issued from grand jury, and it did, but if it had been served on him, I think it was served on him, but if we put a detainer on him, and we didn't, we just served the warrant, did not put a detainer on him, because we knew, you know, he'd been sentenced federally and he wasn't going to be getting out. You really have to make sure there's a detainer in place for like a lot of state charges, because, you know, parole can happen like anytime and they'll never tell you. And so we didn't want to put a detainer on him, because that can invoke something called the Interstate Agreement on Detainers. And so if we filed it, we have to try him, you're correct, within 6 months. So Frank did not do that, and thank God, but it ended up being, because it's one of those negatives, like you have to prove a negative. It's like, did Frank ever file it? It's like, well, I'm not finding it in the file. And of course, the defense is kind of saying, well, I think he did. And it's like, well, show me.
He never did. He never did that. Like, we purposely didn't do that because we knew it was going to start the clock.
Right. But that was one of those fights leading up to trial of like, well, you know, you're out, because if you do not try somebody, it's like a speedy trial demand. If you don't try them within a certain period of time, like you file the detainer and they, you know, object to the detainer, or they file a response to the detainer, you have to try them within a specific period of time. And if you don't do it, case is gone. So that was something that was like really stressing me out, because I come into this case and love Frank, but a lot of times his files were not organized clearly. And and there's a lot of paper in this file. Thank you, Rob Santoro. And so I'm kind of like, okay, I want to make sure that I've got this. And I just could not be 100% certain until, you know, we kind of like basically killed ourselves to figure that out. But that was one of the fights we had leading up to trial. So, and just to give a little bit of timeline on this, you all make the arrest in 2017, don't file the detainer, and he's going to be in for a while. We knew that. But we roll into 2018, just because, you know, and people don't understand this either. It is perfectly normal, even in circuits that don't have, you know, a significant number of cases, to take 2 years for a case to get to trial, even on a serious violent felony like murder. And that's because there are so many cases that need to be moved through the court system. And it's extremely frustrating to victims' families, to witnesses, to, you know, defendants' families, to everybody. It would be nice if we could just snap our fingers and magically make things happen. But there are procedural things that need to happen, arraignment, discovery, all of those things. And in a case like this, there's so much to review, and you've got to give the defense enough time to review what there is as well, and make sure that everything's been served and everything's been turned over, and just all of those things to make sure that this trial is fair, that we're doing it right, and that it's going to stick. You know, if we get a conviction, it's got to stick. So you want to make sure that all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed, all the things are done. And so, and I know that Frank was very conscientious about that, but there's still things going on. Like Tiffany is still proffering, and, you know, there's still stuff going on with that. And I think she proffered at least one more time right before she pled, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I want to say we did, I think we did like three separate proffers with her.
Right. And so she proffered like, again, in like the summer of 2018, she pled August of 2018. And when she pled, it got on TV.
Yeah.
And that kicked off, or we didn't know it at the time necessarily, but it kicked off a whole bunch of things where you knew it, but we weren't sure what to do with it. So she starts getting calls from people on the street. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, real quick before I go to that, you know, just again, keeping in mind, like for us, we talk about this stuff sometimes like very scientifically and like,
right.
Yeah, we didn't want to file the detainer because, you know, that kicks off this and that. We want to make sure we're ready, which is those are all the right things like for our jobs. Right. But like in the meantime, you know, like we were able to tell Linda and Lawrence, hey, look, like we've got this guy is getting charged. You know, this is the suspect and we're confident he's the shooter. And that's about it, right? So they've waited a year and a half just to hear that. And then they like know nothing else past that for the next 2 years. So, you know, just keeping that perspective too. So like we talk about this very, you know, objectively and scientifically, which is what we should do because that's the best way to kind of approach these. But, right. You know, don't lose sight of, you know, 2 years without knowing there's an arrest. I mean, you're talking about 3.5 years of just really not knowing a whole lot, you know? So I can't even imagine how hard that is, you know?
Yeah. Cause you want to know, I mean, you don't just want to know that, you know, hey, we charged somebody. You want to know what happened to my child.
Right.
Right. Right. And you know, that human element does get lost in the system. And you know, it is designed for, you to be objective and look at the evidence objectively, and particularly for me to do that, right? So I, you know, as a prosecutor, that's the job too, is I can't just feel sorry for the victims or the victims' families and want to do something for them, which of course you do, but you also have to be able to look at a case and say, all right, what can I prove? And can I prove all the elements of this crime beyond a reasonable doubt? How am I going to do that? Can I lay foundations for the evidence? Just all of the legal things. And that is very clinical. It is, it's got to be, but it is so painful for the people who've suffered that loss.
Yeah. And I think we being like, you know, me, you, Sammons, Frank, Matt, everybody that I've worked with really, I think mostly does a good job of trying to balance that. Right. Like, and that's why me and Frank were just like, yeah, dude, like there's no sense in waiting any longer, you know, like we've exhausted what we can exhaust right now. It's like keep pressing or don't, and there's no other choice but to keep pressing. So like, that's why we did what we did. And, you know, so I think there's that balance that's always, we don't lose sight of it, but it's just something I wanted to bring up as a consideration in the conversation. But yeah, so right around 2018, Tiffany pleads guilty to like the tampering with evidence for the gun and just, I think, yeah, the false statements too, right? Or was it just tampering with evidence?
I think she had the false statements as well, because, you know, and she admitted to the fact that initially she lied to you.
So that gets blasted on the news, basically, that she's taken a plea deal in exchange for testimony, I think is even what it said.
Right. Right. And because that was part of her plea deal. And and the pleas are done in open court. That paperwork is filed in open court. There are very limited circumstances where that kind of information can be sealed. And again, I'm saying this for the public because people don't understand. You are putting her at risk. Absolutely. We did not put her at risk. She put herself at risk. But the circumstances, we can't hide the fact that that's part of her plea agreement.
Yeah. And then like, you know, like a news story does what? So like a news story on that particularly does what? It does nothing but okay, like you get some readers or whatever, but like that ended up putting her life in danger yet again, because what ended up happening was people saw that and were not happy about that, people being Timon and the people he associates with. And I'll kind of cut to the chase with it, because it came to me, she ended up calling me, I think it was September the next month, and she found out that Los and them had put a hit on her, that they were trying to get to her to kill her. And
right, so the timing of this was interesting too. So it's not, when you say Los and them, there's a name that's going to mean something to a bunch of people in Savannah, at least, that's part of this, which is O'Shea Dunham.
Yeah.
And particularly because Los was locked up at this point too. I think he had gotten popped for some sort of drug charge or probation revocation or something along those lines. So Los is locked up. Los is reaching out to O'Shea Dunham, who at that moment was out.
Correct.
And O'Shea Dunham, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, O'Shea Dunham was a scary dude that a lot of people were afraid of. At the time all this was going on, he was under investigation for two active murders and at least one other shooting within like a month's time. He ended up, what he was doing was execution style robberies. So what he would do is kind of what Los and Timon did, they would pick a target like Chantre Grant. Somebody was with Chantre Grant. It was a female the night he won big on like the Riverboat Casino. He was with a couple friends, but there was one female in particular that was basically kind of like a setup. So she saw him win a lot of money. She let O'Shea know that this guy just won a lot of money. And so they went and O'Shea killed him and took his money and took his gun. And then he ended up setting up another guy on a drug deal and killed him, shot another dude like 20 something times who ended up living somehow, and took the drugs the car drove away and they were able to get the drugs out of the car at another scene. Doesn't matter. But what matters is that he was convicted of both of those murders. But that's what he was doing. He wouldn't even give somebody a chance to give it up. He would just shoot them and then take their stuff. So that's what he was doing. And so, yeah, he was also a suspect in some other homicides that we had, that some of them are open or pending. So I'm not going to go into those, but, right. Basically multiple homicides, dozens of shootings, guy's just a bad dude, doesn't care about life. So right. Would identify the targets he wants, and then he would just go kill people and steal their stuff. So yeah, he was getting kind of contracted out, not really contracted. I think he was just friends with Los and Timon. And I think just out of their friendship, he was probably just going to try to kill her.
Right. And Los, I think, actually was like charged in one of these shootings as a co-defendant or like somehow related to it. Like he might not have been charged with the shooting itself, but Los and his brother in the O'Shea world were involved in at least one of those incidents. So, you know, there's clearly a connection between all of them. And so when that name comes up, Tiffany knows it's serious.
Yeah, well, it was to the point where, and it just goes back to the HVP umbrella. They're all HVP guys and they all grew up together. They came up together. Committed crimes together. That's just what they did. So they were tight. And there was another guy that was friends with those individuals and was in their circle. And he heard about this and cared enough about Tiffany to give her a heads up. Actually, I think he did that directly to her, but also through another family member, was like, hey, you just need to be careful because this is what I'm hearing. And so long and short of it, that got back to me. That guy's name was Calvin Farr. And so then I ended up doing a bunch of work on the threat stuff. Fortunately for us, O'Shea ended up getting arrested for those other two murders. So we ended up plucking him off the street right around the same time. So fortunately he was out of play. And then it gave us a little bit of breathing room. Plus Tiffany was in a place where I don't think anybody knew where she was at. She was not local anymore. So that was good. So we felt decent about it, but you know, so I had to track that backwards. That was a bunch more interviews. I ended up talking to Tiffany's family member. I also ended up talking to Calvin Farr, who he did talk to me, but was just like scared shitless. And
well, that conversation didn't happen until like right before trial either.
Yeah. Yeah. There was, I forget when it happened without looking at the file, but I remember, yeah, we met him. I think he was at work and he had a break and he met us for a little while. He kind of confirmed some stuff, but he didn't really, like, he didn't say, oh yeah, I heard this, which is what happened. But anyway, so we're dealing with all that. And then right around that same time was when we got the call from Henry Watson's family. Henry Watson was a guy out of Florida who ended up being housed in Jessup with Timon Hooper. And he reached out and said he had some information. So at that point you had transitioned onto the case, and yeah, that would have been early 2019 at that point.
Yeah. Cause we had, yes. So that would have been maybe what, January, February we went down there.
Yeah. And so we ended up interviewing Henry, and what he said was he provided a bunch of information, so that Timon talked to him about doing two separate murders. He ended up giving us some case specific information about Lawrence Bryan's murder, including like the make and model of the car that Hooper was in. And we confirmed that Hooper never got any discovery at his federal prison. So this was all stuff that Watson just knew from him telling him. There was a bunch of stuff like that, but he also said that Hooper thought he was going to beat the case because he was wearing a glove and mask, which is what Kieran said. So that was information. And then he said when he beat the case, he was going to kill me and he was going to kill Tiffany. And he told Henry Watson that I had shown up to the Checkers when he was originally arrested. And then also that I was all at all of his federal hearings, which again, that's like little information, but that's like something that nobody but Hooper would have known. Like, he's the only one that would have known that information. So, Henry Watson, of course, he was looking for some help or whatever, like these guys often do, but he never had any violent history. And he came forward this information that he was basically planning to, if he got out, he was going to kill me and he was going to kill Tiffany.
And that ended up, it didn't end up, it was just, it's kind of a how low can you go kind of thing with, you know, I think that told me everything I needed to know about, not that I doubted that Timon was kind of like pure evil, just that complete disregard. I mean, it's disregard for like your role or anything else. Like, you know, I'm going to get out and do this. Like, this is what I'm looking forward to when I get out. Not I'm looking forward to like a good meal. I'm looking forward to getting out and killing people.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. Like you said, it's kind of says whatever you need to know. I mean, like I just do my job, right? I never, he can get mad at me for arresting him and all that kind of stuff, but I was never disrespectful to him. During our interview, I was never disrespectful or rude to him. And that's the way I am with everybody, but, so it's like, other than me doing my job, like that's why he felt compelled to, I guess, want to end my life. So, and again, like you say, it's sometimes you hear that kind of thing and you sort of take it with a grain of salt, right? Like I've had like drunk dudes in the back of a patrol car when I was on patrol be like, I'm going to kill you, and it's kind of like, well, this dude's just kind of talking shit. Like, I really don't take him seriously, but like coming from guys like O'Shea Dunham or Timon Hooper, Carlos Richardson, like those guys talk about killing people like eating breakfast. And like, I 100% believe that if he had an opportunity, he would kill me or try to kill me.
Right. So, and you know, these houses also have what I call reach, right? They have people on the outside willing to do stuff for them. And that was part of, you know, this whole lead up, right, during this whole period of time. And we got some of his jail calls from Jessup. We got, you know, emails from Jessup, but we were also getting stuff, you know, like when he came up for court and stuff like that, because he had court scheduled. We took that case. I mean, we walked out of Jessup Federal Prison and like, I went to my office and drafted a new indictment.
Yeah.
That included those threats on your
life. Yeah. Cause we were supposed to go to trial. I want to say like the middle of February of 2019 was when it was first slated. We did the superseding indictment either the end of January or very first part of February. It was like right at that cusp of the month. So it was like just within a couple of weeks of when the trial was supposed to start. And
everyone really angry.
Yeah. But like, what are you going to do? Right. Like we did it as soon as we had the information and, you know, like I'm glad you did that because, you know, I mean, like I said, it was something that I took seriously, you know, had it been coming from somebody else, maybe not, but it was something I took seriously. And, you know, I adjusted my lifestyle for a fair amount of time after that. You know, I always say like the same thing that I tell all the other witnesses and, you know, surviving victims and cases I work. It's like, I'm not going to live in fear, right? Like, I'm not going to move. I'm not going to become a hermit. I'm not going to do any of those things, but like, I'm also going to not be an idiot. Like I'm going to be cautious, right? Like I'm going to like, before I just like walk out my back door, I'm going to like look out the windows to see if anybody's there. Or like, you know, I remember like I had asked for special permission to carry my gun in the courthouse, which they did not grant. And you know, things like that. And I did adjust my lifestyle for a fair amount of time after that, all the way through the trial really, which ended up being August, and my family's right. So, you know, that was what it was, but yeah. So we did that superseding indictment. I kind of put, Tiffany immediately on notice. You went and did the indictment. I kind of called Tiffany. I was like, hey, look, this is what he's saying. Just need you to be aware. Just be careful. And right. To let me know anything that happens. But yeah. So like, again, going back to the type of guy Hooper is, like when we got the jail calls with him and his sister, like he didn't have the discovery yet. No. And this was all the way up into February, like we're almost right before trial. So he had met with his lawyers, but they didn't give him the paperwork. And
he was pissed about it. And she was pissed about it.
Yeah. Because what she was saying, she was like, you don't even need to talk to the lawyer. You just need the paperwork. Cause they wanted to know who to get to. Right. Like they wanted to know who to get to. They didn't care about the facts of the case. They didn't care about working with the attorney to mount a defense. They were just worried about the names that were in the paperwork so they could get to those people. That's all they wanted.
Right. And you know, there was discussion in those jail calls. They were talking about, and I think they were talking about Brittany Boston particularly, that they were going to be getting to her, like, oh, we checked on her and that kind of thing. There was discussion in those calls. There was discussion about the paperwork. It led to me, you know, filing stuff that I normally don't file, like, you know, to seal discovery, which you provide that, but not just to seal it, but to, you know, basically put an order on the defense attorneys, like you cannot give copies to anybody. You can't give a copy to your client. You can't, you know, you can talk to him about it, but none of that. And you can't talk about the names and the locations of these witnesses, basically. I mean, and it's the kind of thing you just never do. But because of what was happening in this case, people were going to end up dead. And that was, I felt like it would be on me at that point in time, because, you know, and we had been having a whole lot of this in Savannah with trials. And I think that that's something we can talk about with Matt too, because he had several that had situations like that, but we've been having a whole lot of, you know, like people getting hold of their own discovery, someone else's discovery, like sharing it on social media to put people's names out there and get hits on people. This has been a very scary place to be. If you are a witness to a crime.
Yeah. And it's a big part of why people don't want to cooperate anymore. Right. It's like, you know,
right. Because I'm putting my life at risk And right. and it, that has turned the whole idea of the system on its head. Like, we're supposed to be preventing this, and yet it's almost like we're complicit in it. And
yeah,
so,
and I'll say, like, I think the whole hits on witnesses and getting to people, that like that, we see it in what we do in the murder world, but you know, that does not really actually happen very often, because you don't normally have people that are willing to go out there and hurt other people on someone else's behalf, right? Like, you right. occasionally get a family member that's willing to do that. You know, we talk about this specific HVP group that we talked about here, and those guys are willing to do that type of stuff, but like, most people aren't. So like, it doesn't really happen very often, right? People talk about it and say, oh, I'm scared, like, to come forward, and like, that's just an obstacle we have to get over in interviews all the time, and it right. really 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 doesn't happen very often. I think like that's happened to maybe one or two cases that I can think of where something's happened to like a cooperating witness.
Right.
And that's over the course of thousands of cases, right. you know, that I'm aware of. So, it, you know,
it's right. When you hear somebody like talking that way about like, oh, I don't want to, you know, come forward about, you know, this forgery, it's like, oh, come on, you know, and I know I'm being dismissive, but I really feel like sometimes it gets overinflated because of the media, right? And of course, that's partly why Tiffany's name was out there, is the media gets involved and it ends up being distorted.
Like, I understand everybody's got a job, and I'm not one to say that people shouldn't have freedom of the press, but like, it's all just tabloidism for the most part at this point in the world. And it's like, there's no responsible reporting. Or there's very little responsible reporting. Like, you know, it shouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, like, hey, if I put this girl's name and face in the paper, like, it's going to cause her a problem, like, with these dangerous people. Like, that's just irresponsible to do that, right? Like, and who really cares about that story? Like, nobody cares that Tiffany pled guilty in exchange for testimony. Like, nobody cares about that except Timon Hooper and his people. Like, they're the only ones that really care to read that story. Nobody else gives a shit. And, you know, other than just people that want to gossip. But it's, you know, so it's.
But it happened with this. Like, I put this case down for grand jury. The grand jury turns a true bill. And front page is, you are being threatened.
Yeah.
Front page of the Savannah Morning News. And again, you know, that was not, and I do want to be clear about this. Jan Skutch, I think, was probably one of the best reporters that covered the courthouse beat in my entire time doing prosecution. That said, I was mad at him, and he knows it, and I told him, because I felt like it put your life at risk and unnecessarily.
Yeah, like, how's that going to help me or her, like, to have that on the front page, right? Like, how is that going to help us, right? Like, that's not going to help anybody. It's just gossip for people to read about and say, oh, that's interesting. But it's like, okay, I'm a human being and I have a family, and like, what about that? Right. Like, what about that consideration? You know, like, nobody gives a shit about that. So I don't know, man. It's like I said, there's so much misrepresentation of fact in news stories nowadays. There's not even any, like, when's the last time you saw a retraction printed? Like, probably never, gosh. Right? They get things wrong all the time. It used to be like the profession cast stigma on a reporter or a journalist if they like didn't fact check things and they just published shit without, you know, actually confirming information or fact. And we've just gotten so far away from that now that like people just put out the first thing they hear, and most of the time it's inaccurate and it's put.
But it becomes gospel. Like, oh, that definitely happened.
But then it also puts so much pressure on law enforcement and even prosecutors to answer the call of the media like right away. I can't even tell you as a sergeant, right, as a supervisor in the homicide unit, I cannot even tell you how many times that like we'd have alert tones go out for a homicide. I'd be on my way to the scene and my supervisor is calling me, my lieutenant or my captain or my major or the assistant chief or the chief. And they're like, Santor, what can you tell me on this? Like, you know, media's calling, what they're asking, what's, I'm like, I'm not even there yet. I can't tell you anything. I'm like, I'm not even at the scene yet. And they want something to release to the public. Right. And it's like, dude, I can't give you any accurate information. I'm not even there at the scene yet. Like, you got to give me like a couple hours to like give you something. And it's just, but that's what it's become. I mean, it's even cases I've done up here. It's the same way. It's everybody's worried about the news story before you even boots are off the ground. Right. Like it's right. What the fuck, man, you know, like, what are we doing?
Right.
So it's just another thing that we deal with in our world that I think we shouldn't have to. You know, there's very few stories that I've read that are like, oh yeah, they're actually helping, you know, they're doing a good job. That's a good story. I know it happens time to time, but not most of them.
Right. I mean, I've said this for years, actually. It's like, I would not want to judge any case or any investigation based solely on what I heard in the media. Because because people ask you, it's like, oh, did you hear about such and such? And it's like, yeah, I heard of, you know, the bigger cases. I've heard about a lot of them. I just now completely ignore the media coverage on a lot of this stuff because it is so slanted or so incomplete. And, you know, I would not judge any case based on solely on what I heard in the media at this point.
Yeah. Plus, right. Like, you know, nowadays everybody's like, oh, freedom of the press. And it's like, well, yeah, but like most of our media outlets nowadays are like commercially and politically plugged into things. It's not like just somebody out here trying to get the truth. Everybody's got their angle, right? It's not really true media. Like I'm the biggest proponent of like transparency, right? Like, I don't think, you know, I think all the open record stuff is good, but I think that, you know, it just needs to be responsible, man. Like there should be responsibility to not jeopardize like these investigations or people's lives. Like that's where I get the hang up is like when that becomes secondary and that's not right. But anyway, we have no control over that.
Right. And I know we kind of went off on a tangent with that, but that the media part of it and a lot of the things that happened, like once that indictment dropped in February, things got really crazy in the courtroom. And I think we need to save that because it affected all of us. It affected, you know, you at this point were not just the detective, you were also a victim. You know, Tiffany was, and obviously the Bryans were, you know, because they had lost their child. And it became a very different dynamic in the courtroom, in part because there was, it created a fight with the judge, essentially.
Yeah. And it was kind of over like the superseding indictment, which was an ongoing issue, not just in this case, but in at least one other case that I'm aware of. No, yeah, probably two that I'm aware of, two other ones in his courtroom. And then it had to do with like the discovery stuff that you were just talking about, your attempts to kind of keep a rein in on some of that stuff.
Right. To keep people from getting killed, which I felt was a reasonable and laudable goal. And to my knowledge, we did from, you know, we still have everybody.
We do.
So that's a big plus. So how would you like for this segment, what do you think people should take away from this? Shit going down.
I guess, you know, just a couple things for like any investigators listening. It's just the detail stuff, right? Like this case, it really was, you know, the biggest pieces were Malika and Brittany, but, you know, it was all the other supporting stuff that came into play. And so you just can't be too detailed. Well, you can be Jason Manley and be too detailed, but he gets lost in the details sometimes. He's a good dude, but
yeah.
So, but the relevant details, you know, there's just
notably,
this case, yeah, this case just couldn't have been pushed forward without that. And, you know, just the length of time it takes sometimes to get there. And, you know, just being patient and at the same time, not losing sight of what the family's going through. And, you know, prosecutors do switch roles sometimes. And that's a big deal. You know, I just recently talked to a victim's family, and they were supposed to be having a trial this past January, and it got continued like 9 months. And, you know, in the meantime, now there's a new prosecutor, a new judge on the case, and they're super worried about it. And I'd like to console them, but I can't tell them that the next prosecutor is a Christy Barker. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know. So those are real life things that happen as people move. And again, like even me moving on to a different position and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing. And then like the last part we talked about is just, if any media people listen to this, just responsible reporting. You know, I know everybody's got a job to do. We respect and appreciate the job that everybody does, but you know, sometimes you just have to be responsible about what you're doing and have a little bit more forethought as to how it's going to affect the people that you're reporting on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, as always, super, super grateful that you were able to take the time to talk to me, especially this weekend. I know you're real busy. And I hope that things are going fantastic for you all up there. But I'm going to stop the recording at this
point. All right.
No.